Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be beginning our third year with two of my favorite writers. Garrison Keillor, poet, novelist, essayist, host of Prairie Home Companion and the Writer's Almanac. His new book of poems is called Oh, What a Luxury, Verses Lyrical and Vulgar, Pathetic and Profound. And we'll also hear from novelist Carrie Brown, whose new book is The Last First Day. Garrison Keillor is many things. Host of Prairie Home Companion, creator of the Writer's Almanac, brilliant humorist and satirist, novelist and poet, that reassuring voice over the airwaves. We're talking with him today about his new collection of poems, Oh, What a Luxury, Verses Lyrical, Vulgar, Pathetic, and Profound. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you. Now, lyrical, vulgar, pathetic, and profound. That about covers it.
Well, the vulgar part, I don't know. I'm not as vulgar as I wish I could be. I was much too well brought up. But there are a couple of borderline vulgar poems in here. Lyrical, I think, simply means that they're metrical and they rhyme. So they're easy to remember. I think they are. That's the whole beauty of meter and rhyme, is that it's easier to remember. 'Twas many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea, a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. I did not write that poem, Edgar Allan Poe did, but I learned that poem when I was in junior high school, and I've loved it all these years, and I have kept it in my head. How much else that I learned in junior high school do I still have in my head? Not much. Algebra, all gone.
Oh, yes. And that goes first.
But Edgar Allan Poe and, When in Disgrace with Fortune in Men's Eyes, still in my head. So that's the meaning of lyrical. Pathetic just means pathos, you know.
Yes.
Sad, self-pitying. Profound is in the eye of the reader. I hope some of them are profound.
I think some of them are. Now, I had the pleasure of reading Love Poem at a wedding last weekend, which is such a sweet poem. And then a few pages later, there's the more rambunctious and rowdy wedding recessional with the refrain, "We're going to have some sex." Yeah. So there's sublime and, realistic. I love that. Why was it important to you to have this combination of different types of poems in this anthology?
Well, these poems were written at many, many different times, and a good many of them, I would say more than half, were written for a Prairie Home Companion to do on the show. In the midst of the news from Lake Wobegon and songwriters and the band playing and Guy Noir and Lefty and Dusty, the Cowboys, to hear something that is clearly a poem, I like that. It's sort of surprising to people. You go to a poetry reading, and of course you hear 20, 30 poems, one after the other. But I like poems to sort of jump out and be surprising. And I think a good many of these are and do. So the variety simply comes from the fact that they were written over a long period of time. And then just on a whim, and because Grove Atlantic agreed to it, I thought I would put them into book form.
Now, in the introduction to Good Poems for Hard Times, you talked about your youthful ambitions for poetry, and you said you'd quit it cold turkey when you were 21, except for the occasional limerick. So are you like Al Pacino? Does it just suck you back in? I mean, is it irresistible to you?
Well, the sort of poem that I write is light verse, meaning a poem that's written to entertain or to amuse. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's unserious. It means that it's written for entertainment. And that sort of poem has always been in disfavor. Even back in my childhood when I loved Ogden Nash and Robert W. Service, nobody thought that much of Ogden Nash, even though they enjoyed him. They thought much more of Robert Frost. But Robert Frost wrote light verse as well. He wrote plenty of it. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire, but if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. That's a light poem.
Mm-hmm. And it's one that's easy to remember because of that wonderful rhyme.
If I can remember it, anybody.
Now, so many of these poems are about place and that kind of specific identity, the hills of Seattle, a foggy day in San Francisco, the busyness of Times Square, a car ride in L.A. You always seem to be drawn to what makes places unique and special.
I think that in this day and age, when the internet, you know, sort of encircles all of us, I think that one has to try for specificity. You know, we're sort of all being mixed together in one big homogeneous soup here. And so I hold on to the idea that places in our country are very different from other places.
And one of those lovely, lovely place poems is Reader, which is set in New York. And I love it so much because it's sort of like the way I see New Orleans, but it's your vision of New York and its life. And I wonder if you'd read that one for us, please.
I wrote this in response to people I know who said, "Don't you feel in danger in New York City? Don't you feel alien in New York?" No, the answer is, because I've been reading about New York since I was a small child. Holly Golightly takes a taxi down to Tiffany's as Holden Caulfield walks west in a hurry. She is calmed by the sight of diamond jewelry, and he by the solidity of the Museum of Natural History. And A.J. Liebling walks along 43rd towards Times Square, 1 o'clock in the morning and all the tourists are gone. He stops at his watering hole, and if there are no friends there, he makes some new ones, a wonderful, grand, old Babylon. Christmas lights in the windows of brownstones, O. Henry's story lingering there. Jim pawned his watch to buy Della Combs, to buy him the watch chain she sold her hair. Jay Gatsby walks to the end of his great yard, leaving the party, the band, the dancers going round and round, and looks at the green light out there in the dark, a distant dock across Long Island Sound. Men in fresh suits, white shirts and ties, and wearing hats come striding out of Grand Central Station, salesmen, CEOs, with the hearts of Renaissance aristocrats, direct from John Cheever's rich imagination. On the 17th floor, Sylvia Plath, in her summer dress, stands at the window and smells the city's mysteries. E.B. White said New York bestows the gift of loneliness. No one should come to live here unless willing to be lucky. And so, in New York, I feel at ease in crowds of strangers here among, from the East 20s to the West 70s, walking through books I read when I was young.
Oh, thank you. I love that poem so much. Now, you've brought so much poetry to light in the world. I love finding new poets through you, and I'm so grateful to you for that. And I wonder how editing these wonderful anthologies, Good Poems for Hard Times, Good Poems, Great American Places, how has this shaped your craft? Do you measure yourself against these other poets? Do you find you're influenced by them?
I put poems in those Good Poems anthologies that I had read on the radio. And the criterion for reading them, sometimes violated, was that they be transparent poems that a listener could get on first hearing. You would need to puzzle that poem to pieces. You could just hear it and get what the poet was saying. And it's surprising how many great poets were absolutely clear. When people think of poetry, they think of it as being slant and opaque and mysterious and behind a cloud. But so many poets were absolutely direct. And so I come, you know, over the years to think of poetry as a vehicle for clear statement without irony of something that one deeply means, as a vehicle for one's most important utterances. When you need and want to tell people you know how dearly you love them and how important they are to you, you turn to poetry.
Absolutely.
And so I don't think I dare model myself after Mae Swenson and Mary Oliver and Maxine Cumin and Anne Sexton, whom I very much admire and read over and over and go back to. I am out to amuse people with a little bit of song and dance, and that's a very, very different thing.
Now, in 2006, Good Poems for Hard Times came out in paper, and I remember it was published on the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and I remember reviewing that book and thinking that I wish FEMA could have dropped it all over New Orleans. I thought it would have done so much more than so many other things. And you have often made the point that poetry gives people courage and contributes to our common life.
I think that's true. I think that while poets have dared to despair, as the psalmist David does, in the end, the message is to be of good courage and to love this world and to accept this great gift of life and not to give up. I think that is the clear message of all of the great poets, was to hang on and that life is worthwhile.
Absolutely. I was just talking with Ann Patchett, who, like you, is the proprietor of an independent bookstore. Yours is Common Good Books in St. Paul, of course. So like Larry McMurtry and Louise Erdrich, you've stepped into that lovely fellowship of books. Do you spend much time there?
I come in about once or twice a week. I'm one of their best customers. And I always go away with a big stack of books. That's one reason I started a bookstore, was so I'd have a place to go and buy books. I write a limerick every week up on a whiteboard behind the counter, and I talk with my manager and talk with whoever's behind the counter. I don't try to run it. I think it would only be confusing. They do a wonderful job, and they're in very close contact with our customers and friends who come in, and they have a much better sense of what people are looking for. The store is breaking even, and that's all I can hope for.
That's fantastic in this day and age. And I love their motto about reading local, which is something we, of course, all believe in. We've been talking with Garrison Keillor, whose new book is Oh, What a Luxury, Verses Lyrical, Vulgar, Pathetic, and Profound. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I can think of few writers whose work gives me more consistent pleasure than that of Carrie Brown. Ever since the publication of Rose's Garden in 1998, I have looked forward to her new work with a kind of literary greed. She is the Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at Hollins University, and she lives in Virginia with her husband, the novelist John Gregory Brown. Her sixth novel, The Last First Day, has just been published, and it is indeed a pleasure to welcome her to The Reading Life. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Susan.
Thanks for being here.
I'm very glad to be here.
Now, the main character in this wonderful book is Ruth Van Dusen, who is an older woman, and her life has been full in surprising ways. You seem to have this affection for the very young and for the old. So what drew you to Ruth? What were the challenges and pleasures of writing about her?
My husband teases me that I have always been in love with older men. And I think that the interest for me in writing about characters who are old is that they have a history. They have a deep history, but they also have a present and they have a future. And I was interested in writing about a character in the same way that we enjoy retrospectives at museums, where you can see the end and the beginning and the beginning and the end.
I can see that. I think this has been a great fall for books about older women. I've just been reading Sina Jeter Naslund's The Fountain of St. James Court, A Portrait of the Artist as an Old Woman. I love that title, of course. And one of the interesting things about her book and your book is that so much of it is about pleasure, the simple pleasure of daily life.
Yeah. It's a difficult task, I think, to write about happiness. But it makes for a wonderfully rich reading experience, I think, to immerse the reader in the sensory pleasures of the world and the sensory pleasures of the body. And even if you're old, of course, all those pleasures are just as acute as they were when you were young.
And a lot of what you write about is the comfort to be found in the material world.
Yes, it's so interesting that you say that phrase, actually, because the novel is, as you know, constructed of a pair of companion novellas. And one of the initial titles for one of the novellas was The Material World. And Ruth's awareness of being a body in the world, in the material world, is very much part of the story.
I love it when she takes off her shoes.
Yes.
She's off to a ceremonial event, and she takes off her shoes.
Yes.
And says, I hope no one sees the headmaster's wife.
Yeah, she likes the feel of the grass underfoot, as of course we do. Nice grass, of course, soft grass. We like the feel of that.
And so much of it is about time, the way time both speeds up and slows down at a certain point in life. That whole tension in the title, The Last First Day.
Yes, yes. Well, it's one of those phrases you have to stop and think about it for a minute. And really, that was intentional. I sort of wanted that sense of time blurring. And of course, time moves in our own lives back and forward all the time. We're sort of in the present and we're in a memory and we're anticipating the future or worrying about it. And I was trying to capture that sense of time being very fluid also, and especially maybe for somebody who is old and whose past is very present for them.
Yes. One of the things I love about this book is that it shows how many choices there are for women's lives. And you make a point of placing Ruth at Smith a few years behind Gloria Steinem.
Yes.
But Ruth doesn't make that choice, does she?
No, she does not. And yet, of course, she struggles with where she finds herself, both wanting to be her husband's companion and believing in him and admiring him and believing that the work that she can do to support him is real and valuable work. And also with, you know, the old Betty Friedan tension of feeling as though her life lacks value in some way because it is not autonomous. I think that for that generation of women, those choices were actually very painful choices, and they did feel like choices. Mm-hmm. Really, until, especially if they raised children, and in Ruth's case, of course, she didn't have her own child, but she had all the children at the school. That choice to have an autonomous life was something you had to really fight hard for.
And another part of this novel is so much about finding and appreciating female friendship.
Yes.
I mean, there's this wonderful friend sort of employer that Ruth has named Dr. Wenning. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about her. Wonderfully named, I must say.
Yes. Well, Dr. Wenning is really one of my favorite characters I think maybe I've ever created. Really, she's the older friend I wish I'd always had in my own life. And she is a corrective for Ruth when Ruth is being self-absorbed or self self-centered or fragile, but she's also a great comforter and a great consolation in a way that Peter, who is really the love of Ruth's life, cannot be. He does not fill that same role that Dr. Wenning fills for Ruth. They are two women together.
And their conversations are so rich, and Ruth's dreams are so rich,
yes,
which I find interesting.
Well, it's a fun thing to create a character who is a psychiatrist, and particularly a psychiatrist with a sense of humor, which Dr. Wenning really has. And so she can take Ruth with a grain of salt, but she also knows to take her seriously at the same time.
Right. That pleasure of long-standing knowledge.
Yes, yes.
And that's another point in this book, the pleasure. I mean, these are two people, Ruth and Peter, who did not have the happiest of young lives and who have found such solace and strength in each other. And so much of this novel is about the pleasure of being known and seen over a long, long time.
Yes. Yeah, only connect.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you drew from your own long marriage and family life.
I did. I think it might have been Ron Hanson who talked about every story, every novel being a way for the writer to stage a kind of dress rehearsal about what they thought was coming at them in the future so that they could get prepared a little bit. And I think in some significant way, I was looking at my own long marriage and my own advancing age and trying to imagine, okay, let me go to that place in the future where we will inevitably part, my husband and I, and where we will inevitably be alone, and asking myself, well, what do I do then now? Knowing that now, how do I live my life? And I think I wanted Ruth to be asking those questions all the time as well.
So you were writing toward that mystery, that moment of mystery in the future.
I was, yes. That's a beautiful way of saying it. Mm. Yeah, thank you.
And I love the school setting, which obviously you know very well.
Yeah, well, it's that lovely New England coastal setting. Yeah.
I know. Dash and I always used to sigh and go, oh, Maine. Maine. It's just, let's go to school in Maine. It's perfect.
Somebody asked me recently, it was one of those, you know, it's a blog in which you have to imagine your novel as a movie. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about how much fun it would be to imagine the setting of the movie, to find the setting of the movie, but also to think about that coastal New England light at dawn and at dusk, which is really distinct.
Absolutely.
As light everywhere is distinct, but that particular quality of New England coastal light at those changing moments of the day, which are so significant for Ruth, the sort of early morning hours and the evening hours, very important to her. That'd be really fun to be a filmmaker, you know, somebody who could visually control that setting.
And she's always noticing the light.
She's always noticing the light, yeah.
People think light is so important for painters. I think often they overlook how important it is for writers.
Yes. For me, it's a great pleasure in a story when I'm aware of the light. And of course, you know, think about that wonderful, wonderful Raymond Carver story, what we talk about when we talk about love, which is a story told mostly in dialogue, except every now and then we're reminded that time is passing because the light in the room changes, the light in the window changes. And they're the tiniest of gestures in this story. I mean, they're almost like little Japanese brushstrokes in the story. They're so important.
Well, it's such a lovely book. Let's give our listeners a taste of this book. If you'd read a little for us.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
They made love before dinner. That business not as easy as it once was, it was true. But then you didn't really mind so much about that anymore either. You did the best you could. Yet the old longing was still there between them. When Peter pulled her against him, her back to his belly, when he kissed her neck, ran his hand down her side, following the dip of her waist and the rise of her hip, she still felt that old heat. At dinner, they shared a nice bottle of wine in the inn's pleasant dining room, curtains drawn against the dark window glass. She ordered fish, as usual, and Peter ordered a steak, and then he fell asleep in bed before the nightly news had finished on the television. The deadly account of casualties from the war in the Middle East, footage of endangered harp seals in the Canadian Gulf of St. Lawrence, the revelation of comical indiscretions on the part of a politician in Washington, his name, unbelievably, Weiner. "Oh, for God's sake," Ruth said, holding the television remote, speaking out loud to no one in the pretty bedroom at the inn, for Peter was snoring beside her. "Ugh, their heartbreaking faces, those seals, their gray whiskers. The dog's gray muzzle," she remembered, "the man's face. The faces of the many boys from Derry, the beautiful and the not beautiful, the lucky and the unlucky." Sometimes when she was alone, she actually spoke aloud to Dr. Wenning. "Are you there?" she asked the empty air. For a while that night, Ruth lay awake beside Peter in the dark, looking out the unfamiliar open window into the night sky blazing with stars. There seemed to be more stars than usual here, a conference of them, all gathered together. She put her hand on Peter's back, spread her fingers against his warm skin, and rested it there until she felt his pulse against her palm. "You never knew how much happiness or how much unhappiness would be delivered to you in a lifetime, no matter whether you deserved it or not. So there was really nothing to be done, as Dr. Wenning had said, but get on the bus." "Get on the bus, Ruth," she said. "Make love, not war. Give strangers a piece of your heart. Sing Kumbaya." Ruth had rolled her eyes. But Dr. Wenning had loved that song. A woman who had lost everyone in her family to the Nazis had loved Kumbaya. "Do you know what it means, Ruth, that word?" Dr. Wenning had asked. "It means come by here." "I would like to say that to God sometimes," Dr. Wenning said. "Hey, God, come by here, please. I need your attention for just a minute."
Oh, I can see how you love Dr. Wenning. That's
wonderful. I love Dr. Wenning.
We've been talking with novelist Carrie Brown, whose lovely, lovely new book is The Last First Day. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Novelist Snowden Wright signs Play Pretty Blues Tuesday, November 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Carolyn Cobb signs New Orleans Memories, One Writer's City, Saturday, November 30th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. M.A. Kirkwood signs her young adult novel Clairange, Saturday, November 30th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Matt Sacchini signs Roll With It, Brass Bands in the Streets of New Orleans, Tuesday, December 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Chef John Besh signs Cooking from the Heart, My Favorite Lessons Learned Along the Way, Tuesday, December 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up soon, Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, takes place December 4th through 8th at the Hotel Mont Leon. The theme for this year's gathering is God, Man, and Woman, Faith and the Search for Meaning as Inspiration for the Arts. Among the speakers this year are best-selling author Reza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life of Jesus of Nazareth, Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Fennelly, authors of the novel The Tilted World, Walker Percy biographer Patrick Samway, and novelist Ron Rash, author of Serena. For the complete schedule of events and speakers, check out wordsandmusic.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.